Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And trust me when I say that for the next 30 minutes, get ready to hear everything you ever wanted to know about pronghorns. And they are known in many people's language as antelope, but it's the pronghorns we're going to hear about. And I, for one, really want to hear everything I can. Our guest today is Stephanie Dorries. She is a Carson Scholar from the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment and a Sonoran pronghorn researcher. And I just want to add that I know too much. She is brave. She camps outside in the wilderness by herself. So she goes to places that I never even dream of going and gets research for us to really help with the continuation of the species. I think that's a very fair amount of praise for the work you're doing.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today.
You are brave, Stephanie. It's like we talked before the show went on. I said, do you really go out camping by yourself? And she said, uh-huh. And, you know, we didn't bring up anything about bathrooms because you know I'm fixated with it. So just kidding. All right. We're going to get into some very definite general concepts, but I think it'd be great to start for myself and for our audience exactly what it is you do in the big picture, because I find it quite fascinating. You go into the wild.
Now, my research focuses on understanding how human activity influences the Sonoran pronghorn. Pronghorn are America's version of the antelope, and I work with a subspecies that has special adaptations to harsh desert life.
So like up in the Catalina Mountains where you can't climb, it's so hard to get up there, or where specifically? Just harsh in the terms of no rain, lots of scarcity of food and that kind of thing?
Well, the main issue is that Sonoran pronghorn are faced with extreme heat as well as prolonged periods without rainfall. So pronghorn actually prefer the valley bottoms. They evolved over 3 million years ago on North America's grasslands with the American cheetah. So they can reach and sustain speeds over 55 miles per hour. That's really their strong suit. They avoid predators and other threats by running away and using their really keen eyesight. So the main concern that we have right now is with these extreme conditions, extreme heat, pronghorn are faced with a lack of food before the monsoon rains come, after we've had some of these unfortunately not so great winter rains, if there's not enough food for them, and they can really struggle finding enough water, meeting their food and water requirements out in the wild.
And the operative phrase really is extremes. They have to be able to survive at all. So they are they related to the pronghorn that we see when we go down to like Sonoida and Patagonia? Are they like first cousins twice removed, or where there are still grasslands, or are they a different species?
They're more like first cousins. So Sonoran pronghorn, we don't really understand very well when exactly they became a distinct subspecies, but the Sonoran pronghorn are 20 to 40 pounds lighter than their grassland counterparts, and their hides are a little bit lighter as well. When I look at a picture of a pronghorn, I can tell you for sure whether or not
instantly.
For me, it's really in the neck. How thick is that neck? The Sonoran pronghorn tend to have thinner necks and are just more slender in general and are a little bit under 3 feet high at the shoulder. Pronghorn are just in general smaller and daintier than deer. But the interesting thing about Sonoran pronghorn is that the timing of their fawning seasons as well as their mating seasons have shifted forward several months from their grassland pronghorn to coincide with the desert's unique rainfall patterns.
Interesting. So, adaptation.
Mm-hmm. And we really think that Sonoran pronghorn have special adaptations to conserve water that maybe the American pronghorn don't have. But that's something that we can't really test right now, because Sonoran pronghorn are on the endangered species list and have been since the very beginning of endangered species conservation back in 1967. So we're very limited in some of the research we can do and experiments we conduct to understand more about their biology and physiology.
And is there a specific range, like where they are, the specific species that you get to study?
Well, that's right now I'm studying the one population that exists within the United States of about 202 individuals. That was the last
You're
estimate.
Kidding.
I'm not kidding. It's when we're talking about 202 individuals over 1.6 million acres, think, you know, about size of the state of Connecticut. So it's the size of a large state.
Is it in Arizona?
Yes.
Can we're you
looking
take me
at,
there? I'm just kidding.
I can't.
Well,
we can do a day trip. We can go out
to.
A
day trip.
Right now, we have some pronghorn easily visible to some visitors on Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, Cabeza Prieta National
Beautiful.
Wildlife Refuge, the Barium Goldwater Range.
So they are. You could be riding around and seeing them. I, of course, will not be doing the 5-night overnight hike. What about, I mean, I had no idea that we were talking about what a special show for people to get to listen to. 201 is the number. Are they growing? Is it a success story?
It's definitely a success story. Oh, back in 2002, the count for the Arizona population was 21 individuals.
Oh my gosh, that is really good news.
So there was a severe drought, months and months without rain, and all of the animals that the Arizona Game and Fish Department and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had partnered to collar had died. It was just a very difficult time for anybody working with the species. And
it's only like 13 years ago. So that's a really big, huge increase.
Yeah, wildlife managers have really gotten together and partnered. We're talking about several state and federal agencies working together to help build water developments out in wilderness, working together to build a captive breeding pen on Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge to help provide animals to release out into the wild. And then they're currently starting a second population on COFA National Wildlife Refuge. So it's...
And where is that?
COFA is several hours drive north of Yuma, Arizona.
See, I thought I knew where they all were in the state because we've gone to a lot of them. When you go out and study, which is to me one of the most challenging, and I give you such high praise because it is hard work, what are you studying? What are you writing about? What are you measuring?
We're interested in three things related to the pronghorn. We're interested in their behavior, we're interested in their physiology, and we're also interested in a population response in general. And these three things we're looking at in response to human activity. Now, about 10 years ago, we really started seeing an increase in border activity. Now, the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge and Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument extend for over 60 miles along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I know, and it's really beautiful.
It is, but it's like a lot of areas experiencing those impacts where you have people coming across as well as law enforcement efforts. So that's...
Encroachment.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, it really is. It is. But let's go back for a minute when you say we're studying their behaviors. And you know that I like to be funny on the show. I mean, my feeble attempt at humor time. So when you say their behaviors, I mean, are they frolicking? Do you mean if they're running, where they're going? For the non-scientists, when you say we study their behaviors, what are you looking at?
We want to know if pronghorn are spending perhaps more or less time foraging in areas that have different levels of human activity. That's the fundamental question we're trying to answer. Because a lot of times we can go out and we'll be hiking along a trail, or maybe you're hiking along Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, just a short trail, not too far away from the vehicle, and you see a Sonoran pronghorn doe. And let's say this is February, and we've just had some great spring rains. There's a lot of food for the animal to eat. When it snorts at you, because that's what pronghorn do when they notice you and they really don't want you nearby, they'll snort at you and to get your attention. And then she snorts at you a couple times and then runs away. So that's a response. But we might not really have affected that individual's ability to survive. But let's say we fast forward a couple months, say to July or August, and we haven't gotten the monsoon rains. And it's this same doe is
really hot.
It's really stressed. You're sweating buckets. You know, you just... you're going to use every ounce of water you have on you. And this pronghorn doesn't have a nice backpack with water in it. And so the same response might have different consequences at a different time of year. So what we're trying to do is figure out if, you know, we know that pronghorn are responding to humans, but we want to know if that's really affecting their ability to survive. We want to know, because pronghorn are an endangered species, if that's actually impacting their recovery. So that's...
Now, we drove across Arizona to New Mexico up to Taos and saw quite a bit of what I called antelope. And we got to see something that most people, my grandson, who's 10, said, you know, Grandma, most people never get to see this in nature. It was twins, babies that had just been born. I mean, we have absolute fabulous binoculars. Are they a different pronghorn in New Mexico? It's not part of the group you're studying?
No, those are probably the American subspecies.
Yeah, and there were lots. I mean,
yes.
There were lots. And they were intensely curious.
Mm-hmm.
Are all pronghorn curious? Like you said, the group that you're studying might not come up, but pronghorn, they're like scary curious. They'll come up to the fence, and which I never think is good. All animals should be afraid of humans.
Pronghorn are curious to an extent, but Sonoran pronghorn in general tend to be a little bit more skittish, in part because they probably don't encounter humans
people.
As often.
People. So that's unbelievable. Now, we mentioned the areas which everybody's familiar with about, you know, border crossing and enforcement for that. What are other, in the areas in which they are now living, are there other encroachment issues? Is building a problem? Is, you know, human development a problem? Or is it more just, there's a lot of traffic in that area? Like at Oregon Pipe, let's be honest, there are signs that say don't leave your vehicle, mm-hmm. And on. So it's something to be aware of, not be afraid of, but I think be cautious about. But what are the human encroachment issues other than that's one rather sad example?
It's predominantly the border activity.
Okay.
Now, it's one thing that a mentor of mine at Game and Fish mentioned was that, you know, Sonoran pronghorn and probably a lot of other species currently exist not where maybe their habitat's best,
right.
But it's where they were left alone. And
interesting.
So the Cabeza Prieta has been preserved for bighorn sheep since 1939. So really, if you look at where Sonoran pronghorn exists in the United States, it's not along the rivers.
And it's not along the roads.
You know, there's one road. It's called Camino del Diablo, the Devil's Highway. You see graves along the road.
Read a book about the Devil's Highway. You know, that author comes every year, and I can see his face, and I forget his name. He wrote a book, The Devil's Highway.
I've read it.
I know. Is his name?
Is it Urias?
Yes, Urias.
Okay.
I know. He's wonderful. This is a tough question, but I think an honest one. So there's 201 of them, and you're studying them and being, you know, in some ways supported by Institute of the Environment, which I absolutely love and promote, and I'm probably their number one fan. Why should we care? Does it have an economic impact? I know I care because I don't want any species to ever disappear. But are there really other reasons that you can cite that why we really should care? Is there an economic advantage? You know, what's your personal thinking on that and professional experience?
Well, right now, Sonoran pronghorn really don't hold an economic value. And if you look at the large scheme of things, even if you're on the Cabeza Prieta or you're visiting Oregon Pipe, it's seeing pronghorn is a very rare experience. So a lot of people really aren't paying to come see them. And we don't really understand what their ecological role is. They've occurred such low densities that at present it's probably not substantial, but that's something where I think we could potentially conduct research in the future to help get a better understanding of their role within the ecosystem. But in general, I think it comes down to this, just the inherent value of a species. There's nothing like driving along and going up to Charlie Bell Pass on the Cabeza Prieta, but pronghorn occasionally used during migration. And that was the first time where I saw wild Sonoran pronghorn. It was just this amazing experience to see these tan and white individuals.
I get it. I wish I could have seen it with you. So there is that beauty and the nature lover that sees it, and then it can become an economic value because you see places all over, like in Patagonia, where there are birders that come from four corners of the earth to go and sit and see the coppery-tailed trogon. I mean, seriously, you see them with their cameras and they're staying. So it can be something of an economic value. What made you decide to focus on this area of expertise? Tell us a little bit about your background and your journey to be this excited and passionate about this small population. You probably know them by name, if there's only 200 of them.
I know them by number.
By number, okay.
Well, I actually, when I came to Arizona back in October of 2008, and if you'd asked me a couple years before then, if you'd told me I was coming to Arizona, I would have thought you were crazy.
Right.
But I ended up coming to the desert, and I absolutely fell in love with the landscape. I fell in love with how beautiful and how stark and incredible everything was, the wide open spaces. And then as I started working as an intern on the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge with the Student Conservation Association, I was able to work with the Arizona Game and Fish Department at the captive breeding pen and help participate in some of the captive, help releasing some of the pronghorn from the captive breeding pen out into the wild. And it was, that just had a huge impact on me personally, because we were actively contributing to the recovery of an endangered species. We work with some really well-qualified, experienced people who are committed to science-based management. I was very impressed with that as someone just coming out of university and still wondering what to do with my career. So afterwards, after my internship, I started working with the Arizona Game and Fish Department at the captive breeding pen, and then later started to do research trying to help understand how the recovery efforts, like the water developments and some of the feed stations, put it that some of the management efforts might be impacting the population, whether they're facilitating recovery or not.
And how wonderful it is that there are people, like I'm with you, every species matters, especially at this point. The shape the planet's in and where we are as the Earth, as Mother Earth. I think it's really incredible. Who are some of the other good partners? Like, I know when I have had some other guests on, like, I'm in love now with the Tucson Wildlife Center out way out east that takes injured animals and does a whole reintroduction back into the wild. I mean, I'm like, people thought it was the International Wildlife Center with the stuffed animals. I said, no, this is a place where Game and Fish and, you know, Highway Patrol and TPD and the Forest Service know that there's an injured wild animal, there's a place to go 24/7. So who are some of the other good partners that you'd like to give some shout outs to that are helping? Because it takes a group.
Definitely.
It's a big, vast land.
Definitely. That's exactly my experience. And Arizona Game and Fish Department, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service.
Okay.
We work
love
very,
them.
Oh,
love
yes.
them.
We work very closely with the U.S. Air Force as well as the U.S. Marine Corps that help manage. I'm not kidding. Some of the very first dollars to go towards conservation of Sonoran pronghorn was from the military. So, it's the Barium Goldwater Range, this large expanse of land to which the public and development does not have access is a huge reason why I think the pronghorn are doing so well.
And it's really, I mean, the military does in almost every area that I have people interviewed on, their R&D for water conservation and solar and alternative energy and food. I mean, they're really at the forefront. They put a lot of research dollars into, you know, for different reasons, but it benefits us all. So that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, we're also working with the Bureau of Land Management, Department of Homeland Security, and my apologies go to anybody else that I'm forgetting to mention, but it's really an incredible partnership, and that's the only way that we've been able to go from 21 individuals up to over 200 today.
That is really good news. I mean, that's really a big number. When you are out there, like out there, and spending the night, what are some of your biggest challenges? I mean, do you ever get afraid because of the border issues? Are you a person that can be a long time by yourself? I mean, there's got to be things that come up, I would think. Or is it, you know I have friends that love to go out and get lost in the wild for, you know, backpacking by themselves for a couple of weeks at a time.
I truly...
It's a special person.
It does. There are certain characteristics, but I just truly enjoy being out in the desert. I don't mind the heat so much. I just drink a lot
Thank
of water. Yes, and I enjoy camping. Most of the time, or the way the border impacts go, I just try to be consciously aware of my surroundings. So the phrase that we always keep in mind is keep our head on a swivel and always be aware of where we are. And
just be aware. Be aware.
And it's trying to, the big challenges are really trying to focus on my mission. I want to locate groups of collared pronghorn. And when I say collared pronghorn, I refer to the animals that some of them caught in the wild, and some of them released from the captive breeding pen that are fitted with these radio collars that emit a pulse at a specific frequency. And then I have a receiver and antenna that I program, and I can track these individuals. And so that's some of the biggest challenges.
You're pretty excited, I bet, when you hear the beep, beep, beep.
we are.
That is a big deal. What are you doing in terms of, like, I think it'd be great to talk about the Carson Scholars Program a little bit. And the sharing. I think that the thing I appreciate so much is that what the Institute of the Environment is attempting to do is not just have the science remain in the science world, but get scholars like you to be able to articulate what you're doing, engage more of the public. What has been your experience in High Five for Carson Scholars? And you know, you get together. I mean, I think it'd be fun to talk about that a little bit, because I really am a believer in matching the science to mainstream people that can, in ways that can be understood, that isn't just science. I don't want to read a scientific journal. I want to know that there's 201 pronghorn that you're keeping track of and that the population is going to grow.
I think, personally, I feel like the Carson Scholars Program has really created a community for us to learn how to just use different words, and in many cases, learn how to better communicate with each other. Because a lot of us, I feel like these days, most of us are getting into very specific disciplines. So even
it's
though
very specific,
so yeah,
very, yes.
Even though we might be in, say, we both might be in the School of Natural Resources, we're talking about completely different things. So it's sort of challenging us to better communicate with each other, providing feedback so that we can become better communicators with the public, and really just giving us a lot more tools to go out and try to share our knowledge more effectively. I think that's
And to me, that's important. The whole integration of thought that I like. None of these things are happening in a silo. And the more that we know about the work of other, you know, areas of focus and all that, to me, it makes it all stronger, because you might need something from somebody else, and if you're not communicating, it doesn't even come up. So I think that's a really big part of it for me.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why I wanted to return to graduate school, because I really enjoyed working in management, but I do think there's a disconnect between research and management. And it's very important for us to be able to sit down at the same table and communicate our findings and really, really work towards fostering a partnership, not just handing over data, not just requesting data, but like I said, fostering a partnership, because that's where we can really learn something. That's where research can really be taken and applied out in the real world.
Where the really, I hate to be cliche, but where the rubber hits the road. I mean, it's great. And Diana Liverman, she is a champion of the students. I mean, that is her whole thing, is get the students out there, get what they're doing and the information that they have out there. And she is, like, to me, the biggest cheerleader. I love having, you know, spending time with her and having her on the show. So here's, in 5 years, I like to ask this question of everybody, or 10 years, because you're so young. What would you like to be doing with the applied science that you're getting now? What kind of impact would you, Stephanie, like to make? That you're making it already, but what's your vision? Or is it one day at a time and it's all good? What do you have for the big dream machine?
I'm really interested in going back into management and working to facilitate research-based management decisions, because that's the point of our research. That's why we're going out, and that's why I'm going out and working with our field technicians and my advisor at the University of Arizona. That's why we're putting all this effort in. We want to record what pronghorn are doing. We want to collect fecal samples. We want to study or work with our partners at the Arizona Game and Fish Department to understand how the population's responding to human activity, and then hopefully provide information that managers can use to better recover Sonoran pronghorn, to recover them faster.
And it's big stuff. I mean, I'm the first Carson Scholars presentation I went to, this is what stays with me forever, I met Scatman. And I mean, I laughed my head off, but he just is out there studying, is it jaguars, I think, in the Catalina Mountains. But I said, you should have a shirt that you open up that just says Scatman. But I know that's an important part of it. And then what will you do, other than, I love your answer, because you really want, it's that integration of your applied knowledge to the jobs that you will have and the people whose lives you'll influence. What about publications? Are you going to be, are we going to have a little book coming out about the Sonoran pronghorn? I just finished my book, so it's like, oh my gosh, it's a lot of work. But are there other scientists that are interested, I would assume, in the stuff that you're learning, because there are other kinds of pronghorn throughout the United States?
In terms of that, right now I'm just sort of working on, we're really still in our data collection phase.
Okay.
So,
okay.
In about a year and a half. Yeah, we're putting an extensive effort into just being out in the field. And we were talking about a minimum of an hour drive time just to start listening for pronghorn. And sometimes it's even a 4-hour drive powered by an hour plus hike. So we're putting a lot of effort.
It's really intensive.
Yeah, we're putting a lot of effort into collecting these data. And so I hope to begin with just getting an understanding of what this says. Are we just seeing responses, these disturbance responses? Are we seeing something bigger? Are we getting information that could help us better understand how humans and Sonoran pronghorn can coexist?
And, it's really, it's a really big, big, big thought, because it is different. When you go down to Sonoida and Patagonia, the pronghorn there are all along the road. They're not afraid of people. You're talking about I know I shouldn't ever say really unique, because it's just unique population of learning because of their isolation. I mean, they are not people pronghorn.
No, we do see them along roads, but I think it's what I've noticed is differences in pronghorn in different areas. And some of it might have to do with the presence of radio collars. So another important concept that we need to consider is habituation.
Explain that.
Back when Arizona Game and Fish first started putting radio collars on Sonoran pronghorn, they would conduct weekly telemetry flights, and every time they did a flight, and that we're talking about 1,000 feet above ground level, the pronghorn groups would start running. And now, most of these groups don't run. They'll just stare up and then continue along their way.
Okay, so that's an adaptation. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's okay. That's great. Well, we only have 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure that I've asked you every question that I want to know. Is there anything else that you want to share? I think it's important to tell people to go to the Facebook page of the University of Arizona Institute of the Environment. That's one of the shout-outs I want to do, and that's all you have to do. It's University of Arizona Institute of the Environment. There is always something going on. Like, I've done their, the science day when you present, and everybody has the speed thing where the kids present and they tell what they do, and then you have to pick winners who's giving the best research. But they are always up to something wonderful or bringing guests in. So I'd like to do a shout out to them. Is there anything else you want to say in the last minute?
I would just like people to keep in mind that about conservation as a choice, and what can we do to help humans and wildlife coexist.
What a great way to end. I'm going to hashtag that. Conservation as a choice, everybody. I'm sure you enjoyed this as much as I did. Stephanie Dorries, U of A, Carson Scholar, Institute of the Environment, and Sonoran pronghorn researcher. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. And everybody, I'm sure you enjoyed the show as much as I did. Make it a great green day.